Welcome to Anthony Plog on Music. This is Eddie Ludema, the show's producer, here to introduce Tony's guest for this interview, the personnel and orchestra manager of the Boston Symphony, Lynn Larson. During these interviews over the past 3.5 years, Tony's spoken with guests representing many aspects of music, but this is the first time he's had an interview with somebody about the give and take between orchestra management and the musicians. So who better to talk to than Lynn Larson? Lynn has been the personnel manager since 1988 and the orchestra manager since 2017 of the Boston Symphony Orchestra. Earlier, he was a fellow in the American Symphony Orchestra League Management Program and worked for a year with the Denver, Albuquerque, and St. Louis Symphonies. But he began his career as a horn player with the Utah Symphony. He was the head of their orchestra committee and became president for 2 years of the International Conference of Symphony and Opera Musicians, where he represented over 4,000 players across the United States. Lynn has a huge amount of insight into both sides of the management-player relationship, so this conversation is full of interesting thoughts for both players and management. Lynn began his life as a musician by playing second horn with the Utah Symphony for 17 years. During his time with the orchestra, he was head of the orchestra committee, so he takes us behind the scenes to show what happens during a strike and some potential ways of resolving one. Lynn talks about his time as a fellow in the American Symphony Orchestra League program and what he learned from working with the orchestras of Denver, Albuquerque, and St. Louis. Lynn finishes up part one of the interview by talking about his 2 years with the International Conference of Symphony and Opera Musicians. But before we get to the conversation, we'd love to share with you a brief message from our sponsor friends at Dorico, the cutting-edge notation and engraving system software from Steinberg.
Create music that moves with Dorico 5, the brand new version of the music, notation, and composition software from Steinberg. Packed with new features throughout the application, it's the perfect time to update from your current version or to try Dorico for the first time. You can start for free with Dorico SE or Dorico for iPad, which now allow projects with up to 8 players. Or step up to Dorico Elements, which now allows projects of unlimited size and features an expanded engrave mode. For professional use, choose Dorico Pro, which has many unique features you won't find in any other software. Visit www.steinberg.net/Dorico today and make more time for music.
Lynn Larson, welcome to the podcast.
Glad to be here.
When you agreed to do this interview, at first I thought it would be very interesting to talk about your time with the Boston Symphony, what it was like to be, or what it is like to be, both a personnel manager and an orchestra manager for a major symphony. But in studying your career, you've had so many different aspects to your career that demonstrate so many different aspects of the music business, I thought it would be interesting to actually talk about your life story as a way of demonstrating these different aspects. And so, yeah, it's going to be tough. And so if we start at the beginning, I just learned, I thought you grew up in Salt Lake City, but you actually grew up in Idaho and you picked potatoes when you were a kid.
I did. I grew up in a little town called Shelley, Idaho. In fact, in my family story, my family, when I got the job in Boston, many, many years later, when I got the job in Boston and I called my father to tell him I'd gotten it, and his first response was, "Not bad for a kid from Shelley." And that's kind of the family joke for anyone who accomplishes anything. It's always not bad for a kid from Shelley. So it's never far from my thoughts and never far from my family.
Uh-huh.
My family, yes, I was only at the age of 10, we left. We moved to Salt Lake City, which is actually where I started playing French horn in fifth grade. Started playing French horn, had some private lessons, did the usual thing. I did youth orchestras and all state and all that kind of stuff. Started playing at the University of Utah my first year there. About halfway through my freshman year, I got a call from the principal horn in the orchestra, Don Peterson. It's on a Sunday night, and actually I've been studying with him. He said, "Would you like to come to a rehearsal tomorrow?" And I said, "Sure." You know, I figured go listen or do whatever. And at that point, the Utah Symphony rehearsal started at 8:30 in the morning, which now just sounds like the middle of the night. And so I wasn't really thrilled, but I couldn't say, "No, I'll come listen." I said, "Sure, I'll be there." He says, "Well, get there early so you can warm up." And I said, "Warm up for what?" He said, "Well, the third horn is sick. We want you to play third horn." So this was in actually the month before I turned 19, so I was 18 years old. And we're doing Tchaikovsky's Fifth. And I thought, okay, he says, well, we don't know when the third horn will be back, so it might be a day, it might, you know, we don't know. And so I go to the rehearsal scared out of my mind and played through the rehearsal. It went mostly okay. I don't really remember it all that well. And then turns out that the third horn player was sick. He was out the whole week. So I ended up playing those first 2 weeks with Utah on third horn and loved it, but scared me to death, but I loved it. I played for a couple more years with the orchestra while I was going to school as the assistant horn. I'd come in on occasion. I didn't work all that much, but enough. And then the second horn position opened up, and I took the audition for that one and was lucky enough to win the position. So I started playing second when I was, 21 or so.
Wow.
Started playing second horn. And again, scary. Had a lot to get used to. You, in a professional orchestra, such as Utah at the time, you play as many concerts in your first season as you played in your whole life up to there. And so it's a pacing and workload and how you do it and the pressure of performing your best. But I enjoyed it. I loved it. And it turned out I loved playing second. I'm actually well mentally suited for playing second. I love being supportive. I love making the person to my left sound a little better if I can, which was the job.
I remember actually when you were in the orchestra, because I played 2 years with the orchestra.
Yeah.
And the conductor was Maurice Abravanel. And I would assume that when you first started, he was probably very nice to you because he was not a dictatorial type of conductor. But I also remember, as you said, those 8:30 rehearsals in the morning. And if you had a week where you're doing, I remember 1 week doing Mahler's Seventh, and starting with Mahler's Seventh at 8:30 in the morning is just like by the end of the week, your chops just feel terrible.
Oh, it's horrible. Plus, you know, you have the night concert or you do a rent-out concert up to Ogden or Logan. You come back and you're still going the next morning. It felt really like a blessing when it went to 9:30 rehearsals.
Yeah.
Which is still in the orchestra world is still too early.
Yes, of course.
But it felt that way. And I remember you playing, and pardon me for digressing a little bit. We used to go out to different high schools in the Salt Lake Valley, and we would play youth concerts in the high schools for the students, which I thought was a wonderful way to do it. And we did water music. And I'm not sure if you'll remember this, but we had a principal horn at the time, Jeffrey Kirshen, who went on to play third horn in Philadelphia a few years later. And so we were doing water music, and you started taking liberties with the trumpet line.
Ornamentation?
Which, of course, ornamentation. Yes, yeah. Ornamentation would be the kind word for it.
Approximation?
But the ornamentation, it wasn't so much the ornamentation, because then, of course, the horns felt obliged, because the trumpets started, and then the horns felt obliged to copy the ornamentation, which we did, and it got rather inventive.
Yeah, okay.
And sometimes a little challenging, but it wasn't that. It was at the end of it when you kind of took the trumpet and kind of threw it with your right hand and up in the air I'm not sure. Anyway, it was quite effective. And the kids loved it, and we loved it. So,
boy, I have no recollection of that at all.
I know. It's one of those things you were probably, because it was 10 in the morning, you probably did because you're tired. But
what I do remember, though, was Don Peterson, your first horn player, who you studied with, was an unbelievably great soft player. I don't know anybody who could play
soft.
I don't
know how he did it.
Could. Yeah. And also, he was always thin, and he could put away so much food. And those two things just amazed me about him. I mean, a wonderful player. I remember actually playing Oberon Overture. And, of course, there's the horn solo at the beginning, but then there's a sort of a touchy little, I wouldn't say fanfare, but a piano or pianissimo passage with horns and trumpets. And I remember going to ask him if he could play just a little bit louder, that it would be more comfortable for me, and that someday I'd do something good for him. And he did, so that helped.
Yeah, no, I had to really learn how to play very, very soft to match him. So not a bad skill, actually.
No, it's a very good skill. Yeah. David Bilger, he was with Philadelphia for many, many years. He said, you get your job on the audition by showing you can play loud, and you keep your job by showing you can play soft. Yeah, and I think there's a fair amount of truth in that. But anyway, when you went to the University of Utah, you went as a horn major, but also as a business major. And why did you choose business?
Because I wanted to get a real job.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I never envisioned, even when I got the job in the orchestra, which was, I mean, it was a full-time job. But at the time I joined Utah, fun fact, it was the 11th highest paid orchestra in the country.
Wow.
So it was a good job. Mm-hmm. And so it was full-time, and my, shall we say, my education, my formal education at the university suffered as a result, because I couldn't keep both of them up. And so I never thought it would, how it could last. And so I was trying different majors that would prepare me for a job, basically. And some of that is my father sitting on my shoulder, whispering in my ear. Some of that's just a practical thing, because you never know. You know, as a musician, you're one broken lip or one traumatic incident away from being unemployed, and there's always that feeling. So I got accepted to the business school there. I actually spent a year doing business, but never really took off. But it prepared me for other things later on that would come along.
When did you join the orchestra?
Well, I started playing assistant in March of 71.
Okay.
And I started a second horn in the fall of 73, I believe. Maybe 74. It all runs together.
Okay. And I actually, I was in the orchestra. I started in the orchestra from 74 to 76. So you were in the orchestra for 17 years. How many years were you in the orchestra before you started the being on the musicians committee, the chair of the musicians committee with the orchestra?
I was in the orchestra maybe six or seven years.
Okay.
And there's a players committee, I think they call it the orchestra committee there, that at the time with Abravanel, it didn't have a lot to do, because Abravanel ran the whole thing. And you didn't. The normal position for a players committee is to go in and represent the musicians with management for working conditions and all kinds of things. And that wasn't the function at the time so much. And I used to refer to it as the flowers and cards committee, because that was basically the purview of it. That's the whole thing it could do. We didn't negotiate. We just didn't negotiate. Abravanel ran the pretty tight ship. He would tell the musicians what they were being paid. He would tell the board what they would raise. And then we went from there. And he was very, very concerned that the musicians have what he referred to as a 52-week wage, so that they would have some financial security in order to keep playing. And so he pushed the board to increase the number of weeks. When I first started on second horn, when I won the audition, it was a 34-week season that was in my first contract. By the time I started actually sitting on stage a few months later, it had increased to 38 weeks, and then it went to 42, and then it went to 52 within about 3 or 4 years. So it became a 52-week orchestra. And that was Abravanel's, that was his doing. That had nothing to do with collective bargaining or anything like that. That was strictly him pushing from the top. And then when he left, when he had his stroke and stepped back, then the players committee, which I was on at the time and was chairman of at the time, realized we didn't really have a really good collective bargaining agreement. We didn't. The agreement the musicians had was like 3 pages long, and no work rules, nothing was defined. And so we took upon ourselves to write a trade agreement, to write a collective bargaining agreement. And the first time we had to actually sit down with management and start negotiating. And so that was a big job, and there's a lot of great people in the orchestra who stepped up and helped and put that whole thing together. So we actually ended up writing from whole cloth the trade agreement. And as part of the exercise of that, I collected all the trade agreements I could from around the country and read them. I wanted to see, I wanted to bring the best of what the other contracts had to offer. And I will say this unashamedly, and I've said it before, even in the circles I am in now, the Boston contract was horrible. I put it aside because it was basically, it was convoluted, it was dense, it was too narrative, not objective enough, way too subjective. And so I set it aside, I'd read it and had a hard time understanding it and following it. And I followed other models, you know, LA, New York, San Francisco had the best models at the time. So we fashioned the collective bargaining agreement after those orchestras and kind of ignored Boston, which would come back to haunt me later.
Really? Okay. What was the management?
We'll get to that.
Was the management in Utah sympathetic then to when you came to them with this new collective bargaining agreement?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. And we had, I'll say it plainly, then we can decide if we edit this later or not.
Okay.
Part of having a Bravenel at the heart of the organization was that he told everybody what to do. So everyone on the management side was in execution mode. They were doing what they were told, and they were given assignments and goals, and that's what they did. But the center of it and the beating heart and the brain was Bravenel. So when he stepped back, there was a huge void. That void was, shall we say, filled with chief executives who had never been near an orchestra, didn't understand the business. They were given the position for other reasons than their leadership skills in a arts organization or an orchestra in particular. So we had a difficult time negotiating with them because we had to teach them what everything meant. Mm-hmm. And walk it through. And to some of their credit, a couple of them were fairly, they understood their lack of knowledge and they accepted the cooperation. So we did come to some agreement. And so we did get a new contract put in place. But we did have difficulty later on as the management's changed. And we pushed for professional management, which you legally can't do. It's not a subject of bargaining. You can't force a board to hire a manager, but you can certainly say it away from the table. And so we were trying to get a professional management. We wanted a manager whose career depended on their success as a manager. And so we finally did get that. We got the general manager from, I think, Chicago came and took over and so he knew what the contract was. He knew what a service was. He knew what a rehearsal was. He knew why you couldn't rehearse at 8:30 in the morning. He knew why you had to rehearse a little later. So that was okay. And then we kind of ran into issues with him too.
Was Joseph Silverstein the conductor by that time? The music director.
I'm leading up to how I met Joey.
Okay.
Because there's so many webs in this thing. As I said, I think it was the third manager we were on and the second or third interim manager we were on. And the negotiations were tough because we were pushing hard. It was at a time of high inflation. This was in the early 80s. Yeah. And it was high inflation. Orchestras were settling for double digit amounts, you know, 10, 15, 20% because of inflation, and things were booming and it seemed like everyone get it. So, of course, our musicians had the same idea that we should get that. It's that same kind of a settlement, same kind of a contract. And in the meantime, we had gone through one music director, Vrujin Kojin, whose contract was not renewed. And then we went into a search and found another music director, and that was Joseph Silverstein, who was the concertmaster at the time of the Boston Symphony. Small circles here.
Yeah.
And he was due to start... I should look up the year. I want to say 81, 82, somewhere in there. Anyway, he was due to start as music director. At the same time, we were just finishing a contract negotiation with the orchestra. The contract expired before the season began. And so we had a rather contentious negotiation. I was chief negotiator. And we did have an attorney at the table with us. And we pushed as hard as we could and didn't make very much progress. And part of the challenge we had was, and from the musician's point of view, you never want to ask for something from the management that they're incapable of doing. And so I didn't have a lot of confidence in the fundraising abilities of the organization at the time. They've since professionalized and doing very well. But at the time it was a little questionable. So we had come to the close of the negotiations with a tentative agreement that we kind of begrudgingly said, well, you know, if it's the best we're going to do, and so we'll do it. We'll present it to the orchestra, but we're not recommending it. But we'll present it to the orchestra. The chief executive went off on a cruise. The orchestra got together and met just before the season started. This is the week it started. And I remember the meeting was very, very, very contentious amongst ourselves. The contract that we had, the last contract on the table, was insufficient for what the orchestra thought they deserved, and they were not wrong. They were not happy with us as negotiators that we had not pushed harder, that we'd not pushed further, which I understood the frustration too. And so the discussion started talking about in the orchestra, well, what are we going to do? Because we don't want to accept this. And so I got on the phone with the chairman of the board at the time, who was Wendell Ashton.
Oh, right.
Yeah, he was the publisher of the Deseret News. He was the biggest fundraiser. I mean, he would, and he loved the orchestra. He really loved the orchestra. He was also one of the governors on the Federal Reserve Board, which is where I caught him. He was heading for a meeting. And I called him, and I couldn't reach the CEO because he was on a cruise somewhere. So I called Wendell, and I felt bad because I loved Wendell. He's a good man. And he, as I said, he loved the orchestra, and he fundraised like crazy for the orchestra. And I just told him that we were at a point where the orchestra wasn't ready to ratify a contract, but we needed to talk to someone. We needed to finish and go back to the table and try to clean some things up. Well, he's not involved in that level at all. So there was no one to negotiate with, no one to do an 11th hour deal with, literally. So I went back to the orchestra, and they're waiting. I mean, they're in the other room. And I explained what was going on, and that I suggested maybe we extend, maybe we don't. The orchestra decided they wanted to strike. We'd prepared for that. I mean, we had discussed it on the negotiating committee, and we had a plan in case it went that way. We did not engineer it nor push it at all. It was a frustration strike. It was not so much of the principled strike as it was a frustration strike. Frustration with, that we couldn't get anybody to come and talk to us, et cetera, et cetera. So the orchestra voted to strike. And then it came together like, that was a great, great band at the time, great orchestra at the time. We had a member whose father-in-law had a printing shop. So he volunteered to start making the strike signs, and so he worked with our lawyer to have the language for the placards, because we were going to pick at the orchestra the hall the next morning. And then I had to call Wendell back on the phone and tell him that the orchestra had just taken a strike vote and the orchestra was on strike. Painful call.
I can imagine. You know,
really painful call. And so, then I talked with the symphony attorney too. So, and all the time we had a very good attorney, Danny Kelly, who I think still lives in Utah. And he was advising us on the way, you know, so that we were legal and that we followed the rules, because there are rules to it. So the orchestra is all set to go, and we'd had a media spokesman selected, and we were going to throw a picket line up in there. That was Joey Silverstein's opening week.
How nice.
And so, how nice. And so, oddly enough, there was a big opening dinner at Walker Wallace's house, which is out in the Holiday or Cottonwood area, for the orchestra and for fundraisers and for the new maestro. And it was all supposed to be, I think it was wasn't that night, it was the night after. So then the question there was, do we go to the dinner? And I said, yes, we go to the dinner. And you talk to everybody you can and explain, you know, basically we go to the dinner and like we would, and be gracious. Don't be confrontational. And so the dinner went on. So that was the news in the local news that night, was that the orchestra was on strike, and yet the orchestra's inside the house. They were out front shooting this footage. The orchestra's in there having dinner with the board and with the new maestro and all that kind of stuff. And that's when I met Joey. Anyway, the board had a really good, how should we say, they had a labor specialist who was a negotiator for management. In fact, his main audience was dealing with Teamsters and meatpacking companies and stuff like that out in the Midwest. But he was on the board, and he was willing to help. And so I remember Wendell went to him and told him, because Wendell told me this, Wendell went to him and told him to settle it. So at that point, we were dealing with the board representative. His name was Ross Thorson, and loved him. He has one of my favorite lines, by the way. Let me digress. One of my favorite lines in negotiation, and I've been in dozens of negotiations since then. One of my favorite lines, we were talking, and my one of my best friends, and Larry Zaltman, who was the principal trombone player, still around, and we do the good cop, bad cop routine with the management representatives. Larry would play the bad cop, and then I would play the reasonable person. And so Larry was going on with Ross one day, talking about all, you know, how we needed to have this limiter, that change, and it was really important and all that kind of stuff. And Ross kind of sat back, and he had a way of sitting back and looking over his glasses at, you know, he's listening, but he doesn't really care kind of thing. And he'd look at it, and then I kind of interrupted Larry's little discussion about all the awful things that were going to happen. I said, you know, but you know, we can find a way to avoid this kind of thing. Let's talk here. Let's be reasonable. And then Ross turned to me and said, well, let me understand something. He said, I'm used to dealing with meat packers. When they tell me they're going to go on strike, they get axe handles and they walk out into the parking lot. What do you guys do? And I said, I had to keep myself from laughing. I said, well, we don't play. He goes, okay. It was like, anyway, so we're on strike. Joey's opening week. Everyone's anxious to try to get the thing done. Anyway, long story short, I don't want to belabor it. So we met with Ross and the board attorney, and Larry and I in the committee, and we came up with a settlement, basically that we could support. And so the strike lasted. It took us a few days to get that done. The strike lasted 5 days. So actually, Joey's opening week went on kind of as scheduled. The orchestra lost a week's pay. It was a good settlement, and at least it was on the orchestra. It was the first time, I think the only time Utah has struck. And that's how I met Joey.
In hearing that story, a couple things come to mind. Number one is, by that time, even though that was sort of your first job, you know, in the business of music, by that time you really had some chops. You really knew what you were doing, probably from studying contracts of other orchestras. And right. Then I wonder also if it sounds to me, at least for me, if I was in your position, I would be incredibly stressed most of the time. Did you ever think, I don't think I want to do this anymore? Or did it seem like this was really, this really got you going? You really, in a way, sort of enjoyed it.
Well, actually, I liked being at the Nexus. I liked being, okay, how do I say this? Musicians approach the job different ways. There are some musicians you run across, it's all about the music, it's all about the art. It's all about the phrase, the expression, and what they can do out of that, and they're artists, and that's all they want to focus on. And that's true. I tended to want to get down to the nitty gritty and look at the things that would allow them to do that, because it exists in a contractual structure. It exists, and it isn't just pure art. And so I was intrigued by being at the table or at the fence or whatever you want to call it, where the aspirations are reduced to contract language.
Right. And you can make a situation where people then are free to do their art comfortably.
Correct. And what it takes to do that. For instance, when we were talking with one of the managers in Utah and had to explain to them why the orchestra really couldn't play much more than 2 or 2.5 hours full out at a stretch. It became either counterproductive or not helpful or whatever word you want to put to it. And that's, the musicians know that instinctively, and they know it from life experience, that if you're going to go full out in a concert, doing a Mahler symphony, doing a Beethoven symphony, and go for 2 or 3 hours, you're pretty much spent, if not physically, emotionally. And so how do you reduce that to the rule that would allow the musicians to do their best in the environment that you create? It was stressful, yes. I mean, no doubt, because it was, I remember going home after the strike vote and thinking, what are we going to do? Because the orchestra was basically, they were united. I mean, it was a wonderful feeling politically that way, but it's a tremendous responsibility. Now what do we do? Because there was no guarantee that it was going to end. I mean, it ended in 5 days, which I think was merciful. It could have gone a long time. And other orchestras across the country have gone into much longer strike periods than that. For one would argue, sometimes a good gain, sometimes not such a good gain. But I was intrigued by the process. I was intrigued by the process where management meets musicians.
And you're still in that nexus, I guess, now with your job.
Well, all I moved is 18 inches across the fence.
Yeah.
And some of my colleagues said I had a lobotomy. Some said I lost my soul or lost direction, you know, whatever reason.
Take your pick, I guess.
Take your pick. But I enjoyed playing. I enjoyed playing horn. I enjoyed playing second horn. I was good at it. And I could have just settled on that and had a very nice long career there. And I mean, I was like 30 years old, 29 or 30 years old. And I thought, no. And the exact thought was, I don't want to be sitting here doing this when I'm 45. That's the hubris of youth. And so I had this great belief there had to be places in the U.S. where orchestra management was done right, because I had not witnessed it. And so it was just kind of a faith that somewhere someone's got to be doing this right, and I'd like to do it. There was an organization, the organization at the time was called the American Symphony Orchestra League. It's now called the League of American Orchestras. I preferred the former acronym, and I tease them about that all the time. Anyway, so the American Symphony Orchestra League had a fellowship program that would place a fellow.
I just got it about the acronym, by the way.
That's good. I'm not going there. It'll always be ASOL to me.
Yeah, okay.
And so they had this fellowship program, and strangely enough, I didn't come up with the idea. I was sitting in rehearsal one day, and the third horn walked in and handed me this advertisement for it. He says, "Why don't you do that?" Which, you know, at first I was offended. Like, what? I can't play horn anymore? You want me to go for this management program or whatever it is? So I started looking into it, and it seemed interesting. I never thought I'd get it. And on a personal side, I was going through a divorce, so I was looking for change. It seemed to be a direction I wanted to go. And so I applied for the program. I didn't know how I would finance it, because I would have to give up my job, at the very least, give it up for a year, give up my job, and go to three orchestras around the country and work with the managements and see how they did it. But it sounded. Like something I really wanted to do. I got through the initial interview process and then went back for the final interviews in New York at Avery Fisher, and did my interview with three managers, including the person who at the time was the CEO of the Boston Symphony. And I made it. I passed it. I got offered the fellowship, which meant I took off the 84-85 season, and I spent 3 months in. Started, it was a Denver symphony at the time. 3 months in Denver, 3 months in Albuquerque with the New Mexico Symphony, and then 3 months with St. Louis, the St. Louis Symphony, working with their managements. Three different levels, three very different managers, three very different philosophies. And it gave me time to study kind of management, so to speak, and to see it in real time.
Denver, I think, really had problems probably after you were there. But did you see that when you were there? And did you learn what really works and what doesn't work?
Yeah, I did. Denver had gone through, they'd gotten a new manager who'd come in and given them a really good, I mean, he'd put a lot of money on the table. And which always makes musicians feel good. Anyone feel good. I'd feel good. And so it was a little bit of a sugar high going on in Denver at the time. But it was creating long-term challenges financially, you know, the kind of commitment they made. But the manager was kind of the up-and-coming hot property at the time, and everyone had faith that he'd do it and stuff. I wasn't convinced that that could be done. But who was I to know? I was not a manager at the time. I was a musician.
A question about that, though. If you're a fellow, could you actually go to him and say...
Yeah, we talked about it.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, we talked about it. I had access to the chief executive. That was the deal. I didn't work in their space or anything, but I had regular meetings with them, and my whole thing was I wanted to know what was working and what wasn't working. And so I asked him if I saw him take a certain course in a board, in a staff meeting, he would say things that were, I couldn't figure out why he was doing it. I'd ask him afterwards what he was doing and why he did that. He was very open. I had a very good relationship with him, and it was, kind of a window into how he viewed orchestra management, which is not how I do it, but it's, you know, it was working for him at the time. It didn't work long-term. Then they ran it. That was a presage of their bigger financial difficulties they had in the later 80s and early 90s. And then when they reorganized. So that was very informative, a good orchestra, really good orchestra, good hall.
Not knowing anything about management, I would think that if you're like the orchestra manager, you have to balance short-term with long-term. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's the whole challenge. And as I said, as the lesson I'd taken away from being on the musician side in Utah was certain managements have certain skills and abilities. And if you ask them to do something that they're incapable of, it'll fail, absolutely fail. So I was still looking for that great management, either team or philosophy. And so Denver was, it was like the start of what could have been a renaissance there. It was risky, but it seemed like it might work. And so then I went to New Mexico, small operation. I helped them rewrite their collective bargaining agreement, since they knew I'd negotiated. Everyone knew I was, you know, I was a musician in Utah, and I'd done the negotiations. That was kind of my shtick. And so I helped them rewrite their agreement and organize it a little better. And they had good relations. They had some nice stuff going on. It was a good orchestra. I loved the food and loved the scenery out in the desert. Albuquerque was wonderful. Loved Santa Fe when we go up there. And oddly enough, each orchestra I went to would try to get me to play with them, play horn with them.
Really?
Because they knew I was second horn in Utah. They said, "Why don't you play?" And I said, "No, I'm not going to do that. That's not what this year is about." And I'd set the horn down, you know. And I did a little bit of maintenance work as I went through the year, but it's not good enough to play. And in Mexico, they finally talked me into doing it. We went up to Taos, and what was it? It wasn't Flying Dutchman. Anyway, I can't remember the piece. But they finally talked me, and they needed a fourth horn, so I thought, well, why not? It's fourth horn, so I did it. And the thing I learned from that, they had been complaining to me as a musician. They say they had an assistant conductor. They say we can't follow him. It's hard to work with him, and on and on and on and on and on. And to be honest, I didn't see it. I could not see what they were talking about from out in the audience. I walked around behind the orchestra during rehearsals and would watch the conductor, and I didn't see what they were talking about. And I tell him, I said, I don't see what you're talking about. It seems fine. So then I sat in the orchestra with them in Taos, and he started. And it was like, okay, now I see it.
Really? Just the way he communicated with the orchestra or downbeats or what?
It was just the whole control of the orchestra, you know, is not a bad conductor, but I understood what they were talking about. Let's put it that way. I don't want to go into any more detail than that, but it's like, I don't care what any manager says, if they don't sit on the stage and they don't see from the musician's point of view what they're talking about, they don't see what the musicians see.
Yeah, yeah. Let me ask you a question to go back about managements. You say you can't ask a management to do something they're incapable of doing. Are there any managements where you would think they're incapable of something, but they say, well, wait, we're going to figure out how to do that? Do you think that occasionally will happen?
Oh, yeah.
Or we're not thinking correctly about this, and our thinking has not been the way it should be, and I think we can change that. Does that happen?
Oh, yeah, we'll get to that.
Okay.
That's exactly the function of the better managements.
Okay, is to be able to change.
And so then I went to St. Louis.
A bigger orchestra.
A bigger orchestra. And that's, by the way, that's where I ran into Gene Picorni, who had played in Utah with us for 3 or 4 years.
Right.
You remember Gino?
Yeah.
By the way, the best recording of Jabba the Hutt that I have is when we recorded that with Utah, and Gene played the Jabba the Hutt.
Yeah.
Just if you get a chance to look that up. Anyway, so then, but Gene had then auditioned out, and he was in St. Louis. So I ran into Gene in St. Louis and spent some time with him and the orchestra, great hall. I mean, it was an orchestra played at a very, very high level. And also I ran into several key figures who later, that would mean a lot to me later in my life and along my career. They had a personnel manager and second horn player by the name of Carl Schiebler, who kind of became my, I won't say mentor, he would resent that, but he became a friend, an advisor, and I had a lot of long talks with him about management and what works and what doesn't and how you treat an orchestra. And he was, as I said, he was second horn, so he was in the orchestra, so we understood from the stage point of view how things worked.
Right.
They also had a chief executive, David Hislop, who I think I just saw on Slipdisc, he just got his 17th orchestra or something like that. He's kind of Mr. Fix-It.
Oh, right.
On management types.
Yeah.
Well, David had, I had long philosophical talks with him about the philosophy of management. And to your point and to your question about whether you examine if what you're doing works, and if it doesn't work, you do it a different way. And it's always being self-aware and self-critical and never thinking that you have the answer and always looking for a better answer. And he had done that in St. Louis. He had a really great team. There was nothing for me to do there. You know, unlike Denver, there's stuff I could do in Denver to help them. And there was stuff in New Mexico, you know, help them with their contract and other stuff like that. There's nothing for me to do because it was all being done. And so I thought I'd finally found, this is how management's supposed to be at that point in St. Louis. It was a very good team, very solid. They respected the orchestra. The orchestra was playing at a very high level. Slatkin was there at the time. They were doing great recordings. I think one of the magazines had said they were like the number two orchestra or something.
I think it was Time magazine said they were number one. I remember reading that. Yeah, yeah. In a way, if I could complete your sentence, there was nothing to learn. There's nothing to do there except learn. Maybe you learned a lot about what worked.
Yeah. And so I spent a lot of time talking with David Hislop about what he saw as good management, and with Carl Schiebler in the personnel office. He was the personnel manager about how things work. And Carl went on to be, I think the year after that, or a couple of years after that, went on to become personnel manager in the New York Phil.
Wow. Okay.
Where he was there until unfortunately passed away a few years ago. Hmm. And so, and David and Hislop went on to do other things too, but It was kind of like finding Camelot, a little bit, or Brigadoon, for if you want a different analogy.
Yeah.
That existed at that point in St. Louis. I don't know if they felt that way, but I, as an outsider viewing it, from my lens, certainly felt it was.
Yeah. The interesting thing to me is that you went from there to Ixam, where you were president of Ixam, and that's the other side.
Well, it's back on the other side of the fence.
Yeah, exactly. And as president, you're representing over 4,000 musicians.
Yes.
Yeah. How did that happen? And why did they pick you, since you were in management, essentially?
Well, I finished the fellowship. And at the end of the fellowship, as is normally sometimes, I had about a half a dozen job offers. I was offered a position in St. Louis, which was the one that I actually, when I couldn't take it, I went back and actually cried about that one.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And I was offered positions in a half a dozen other large and medium-sized orchestras, orchestra manager positions. And I couldn't take it for a very good personal reason, is that... I had gotten married to Teresa Borsodi, who was a cellist in Utah. So the year I was away was our first year that we were married. We got married a few months before I left, actually. And so we had her career also to consider. And so when you looked at the jobs I was offered and the salary range of the jobs I was offered, we couldn't give up both incomes and do the job. So I had to basically turn down everything, and I went back to play in Utah, went back to my second horn job, feeling frustrated because I'd spent this year, I wanted to do more. So then I thought, okay, well, if I'm going to be back in the orchestra, I want to do something to help the orchestra. In Denver, I had met the president of Ixam, who was Melanie Burrell, who was a cellist there. I'd met her and some of the other Ixam people. And so I thought, well, maybe there's something I can do, you know, on the orchestra side. So I called Melanie and just said, if you ever need anything, I'm interested in doing more. If you need anything in Ixam, if I can help or whatever, I'd be happy to do it. And the next thing I know, the chairman of Ixam would call me, and they were going, I didn't know it. They were going through a reorganization, where the longtime president was stepping aside, Fred Zanone. And Melanie was going to take over his chair, and they were looking for a president. And they said, would you like to be president? Which I'd never been involved with Ixam before. So it was a very unusual move. And so they invited me to the convention in Atlanta. And they spent the convention explaining to a very skeptical Ixam why they were offering the president chair to this person who'd just been a management fellow, who had not been involved with Ixam before that. So, and I had a lot of conversations with a lot of delegates at the time, and so they could get to know me and stuff like that. Anyway, ended up winning the position, so they voted me in as president. So I spent 2 years as president of Ixam, which was basically just helping with communications countrywide. My responsibility was to do the newsletters, do the settlements, help where I could with disputes and advice.
And you, so were you speak. Playing with the orchestra then again while you were?
Yes.
Okay.
I was still playing in Utah.
Okay. You know, speaking, yeah. I was a member, I guess, of Ixam, you know, because being a member of the union and talking about the newsletter, you will probably not appreciate this, but in, I think it was around 1973 when I was playing with the San Antonio Symphony, there was a quote from my teacher, Tom Stevens, that they put in the Ixam newsletter where at the Hollywood Bowl, there was a rehearsal where the horn section was complaining about the trumpets being too loud. And Tom was quoted as saying, look, guys, if God wanted to hear the French horn, he would have pointed your bells in the other direction.
I've heard that joke before, yeah.
Well, it was printed as not being a joke, but something that Tom actually said. But maybe it is a joke. Who knows?
Well, I don't know.
But that's one of the things I remember about Ixam.
Yeah, it was a good 2 years.
Join us in part two of the conversation, where Lynn goes over his 33 years with the Boston Symphony, first as personnel manager, and also more recently as the orchestra manager. Tony asks him about his audition for the job, which included a one-hour session with Seiji Ozawa. Finally, he talks about the influence of conductor Maurice Abravanel on his life, his responsibilities and duties as personnel manager, and how auditions are run at the Boston Symphony Orchestra. To hear the second portion of Tony and Lynn's conversation, please consider becoming a contributing listener by clicking on the big blue button on the podcast website to start a free trial. You can also go directly to anthonyplogue-on-music.supercast.com. As a contributor, you'll be able to listen to additional audio content and study up on Tony's podcast Reflections, where he does a recap of his interviews focusing on suggestions for students. You'll also have access to our Discord server, where you can join an ongoing discussion while meeting and sharing ideas with other listeners. Thank you for listening in, and be sure to help us spread the word.